I should say that a couple of you have mentioned this over the break, that you'll notice that we're not doing lots and lots of kind of flicking to different references in the Bible and looking at specific verses. I'm doing a lot of the reading of the passages of Scripture that we're talking about. The reason for that is partly because there's a lot to cover and we don't have lots of time. The other reason is that often we're summarizing large blocks of material, which doesn't suit itself to kind of one or two key verses, but needs the whole narrative of those chapters to be told. So that's kind of why there's perhaps not quite as much of that as you'd expect. Hopefully there's still plenty of looking at the text ourselves. And I've put all of the references which I'm making in the talks on your handouts. And if you wanted to take that away and look up all of the references yourself as a follow-up to this day, then I think that would be an excellent thing to do. Cool. In this session, we leave Moses and we jump forward 700 years to the prophet Isaiah standing on the walls of Jerusalem with the Pentateuch in one hand and his pen in the other. The book of Isaiah, in many ways, is the turning point of the Bible. By Isaiah's time, the people of Israel had been in the land of Canaan for over 600 years. They had been given a monarchy descended from the line of David and a permanent house for God to replace the tabernacle in the temple in Jerusalem. But looking back at the centuries since Moses, the prophet Isaiah saw one consistent theme: Israel's covenant rebellion. In Deuteronomy 32, Moses said the people of Israel would be children in whom there is no faithfulness, who would provoke God to anger with their persistent idolatry. And in Isaiah chapter 1, the prophet announces the fulfillment of those words. Isaiah chapter 1, verse 2. Hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth, for the Lord has spoken. Children have I reared and brought up, but they have rebelled against me. The ox knows its owner, and the donkey its master's crib. But Israel does not know. My people do not understand. The people of Israel had broken the covenant just as Moses said they would, and therefore they could no longer enjoy life in God's land, but would be cast off to die in exile. In chapter 5, Isaiah compares Israel to a fruitless vine raised by God into an arid wasteland as a picture of the coming judgment. It represents a key turning point in the Bible as Israel's life in God's land begins to be replaced by her national death scattered amongst the nations. Isaiah himself witnessed the near total annihilation of Israel by Assyria in 721 and 701 BC. And although Jerusalem itself was spared, he foresaw that Babylon would one day replace Assyria and complete God's judgment. It's a turning point in the Bible because Isaiah saw Israel's coming end. But the book of Isaiah also represents a positive turning point. Standing on the walls of Jerusalem with the Pentateuch in his hands, Isaiah looked beyond the exile by taking Moses' vision of the latter days and expanding it into the Bible's most colorful description of God's future salvation. His aim was to show his readers where to look in the centuries of decline to come. And it was on that vision that subsequent prophets like Ezekiel and Jeremiah based their efforts to pass Isaiah's vision on to the grandchildren of his generation. Isaiah, then, is the revelatory turning point of the Bible and the foundation of all subsequent biblical prophecy. But Isaiah's foundation is contained in a key oracle in Isaiah 2, verses 1 to 22. This paradigmatic passage begins the central section of Isaiah's editorial prologue in chapters 1 to 5, and it introduces what I think are the three key themes in the book: new creation, new exodus, and pride and humility. New creation, new exodus, and pride and humility. And so in the rest of our time together, we'll look at each one of these themes, starting with its introduction in chapter 2, and then tracing its development through the rest of the book. We begin with new creation. Turn with me in your Bibles to Isaiah chapter 2 and look with me at verse 1. Isaiah 2, verse 1. The word that Isaiah the son of Amoz saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. It shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established as the highest of the mountains and shall be lifted up above the hills, and all the nations shall flow to it. And many people shall come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways and that we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He shall judge between the nations and shall decide disputes for many peoples. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. The first thing to notice about this vision is the period it concerns. Verse 2 says, it shall come to pass in the latter days. Remember, that was a key phrase in the Pentateuch, reappearing in each of the prophetic poems, which looked beyond Israel's exile to a new exodus, led by God's king, through which he would restore his blessing on the world. By using that phrase, then, Isaiah suggests he is picturing the latter days, the coming salvation which Moses prophesied about. And therefore, in the first part of this session, I want to draw out four ways in which Isaiah's vision fulfills Moses's. Firstly, in the latter days, God's supreme rule will be re-established. In Moses, we saw that the universe began with the supreme God ruling over creation. But since Genesis 3, God's rule has been challenged by humanity's proud self-exaltation. In spite of God's revelation in the Exodus, not even his own people could resist the temptation to turn to idols. But in the latter days, Isaiah says, God's supreme rule will be fully and finally re-established. Have a look at verse 2. It shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established as the highest of the mountains and shall be lifted up above the hills. In antiquity, mountains and hills were the place where people would go to worship their idols. But Isaiah says in the latter days there will be only one mountain, the mountain of the house of the Lord. Just as he once ruled from his mountain garden in Eden, from this mountain he will once again wield unrivaled rule over his world. Verse 4 says he will judge the nations and decide disputes for many peoples. Of course, in Moses' vision of the latter days, that rule was implemented through the king, the Genesis 49 figure from the line of Judah, to whom the nations would come in obedience. And in Isaiah's vision of the future, the same is true. This is Isaiah chapter 11, verse 1. He says, there shall come forth a shoot from the stump of Jesse, and a branch from his roots shall bear fruit, and the Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. And his delight shall be in the fear of the Lord. He shall not judge by what his eyes see or decide disputes by what his ears hear, but with righteousness he will judge the poor and decide with equity for the meek of the earth. And he shall strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he shall kill the wicked. That phrase at the very beginning, the root of Jesse, is a reference to the father of King David. It's Isaiah's way of saying that the king described in these verses will come from the Davidic line of Judah's monarchy. But more importantly for us, it means that this king will be descended from Judah, the one from whom Moses and God's latter days king would come. Through him, God will rule in total supremacy over his restored world, Just as we saw God judging the nations and deciding their disputes in chapter 2, so here it says, he will not judge by what his eyes see, nor decide disputes by what his ears hear. He will rule for God, because God's Spirit will rest upon him, enabling him to rule with God's wisdom, justice, and strength. It's a wonderful picture of God's righteous rule, restored over his creation as it was in the beginning, through his latter days king. God's supreme rule will be reestablished. Secondly, in the latter days, the nations will return to their God. The nations will return to their God. When we looked at Moses, we saw that the nations scattered from God for their rebellion, first in the Garden of Eden and then at the Tower of Babel. In Exodus, God said he was revealing his power so that his name might be proclaimed in all the earth. But Moses knew that rather than drawing the nations in, the Israelites would end up scattered amongst the nations to die in exile. But in the latter days, Isaiah says things will be different. Isaiah 2, verse 2. It shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established as the highest of the mountains and shall be lifted up above the hills. And all the nations shall flow to it. And many people shall come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go the law, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. Like an enormous lighthouse, the mountain of the Lord, lifted up high above all its rivals, will emanate out God's good word, drawing the nations and gathering them to their Creator. They will come into his presence and submit to his rule. As they say in verse 4, let us go up to the house of the Lord, that he may teach us his ways. In the latter days, the nations will return to their God, drawn to his good rule, in fulfillment of the role which Israel failed to perform. Of course, the king will also play a vital role in this work. In 11 verse 10, Isaiah says that he, the king, shall stand as a signal to the peoples, and of him shall the nations inquire, and his resting place shall be glorious. He is the one, the king, to whom the nations will come in submission, drawn to the supremacy of his righteous rule. And as they come, so the words of the Abrahamic promise, recorded by Moses, that in his offspring all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, will be fulfilled. For the first time since Genesis 1, all humanity will return to the Lord their Maker to live under his rule and enjoy his blessing. Which brings us to our third point. In the latter days, God's blessing will be restored on his world. When we looked at the Abrahamic promise, we said that God was promising to restore his world to the blessing of life in his presence. And that is exactly what we see in Isaiah chapter 2. That the nations, they're going up to the mountain of the house of the Lord to enjoy life with him. It's a picture of God's original creation blessing being restored for all the nations to enjoy. Instead of the terror of approaching God's presence on Mount Sinai, the nations will be able to approach God in confident expectation of abundant life. And not only that, but God's blessing will spread out across his world. As it says in verse 4, people will beat their plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks, and nation shall not lift up sword against nation anymore. As a result of God's supreme rule, a reign of peace will spread across the globe as all mankind submit to the judgments of their king. In chapter 11, this picture gets expanded even further as Isaiah unfolds a picture of full-blown fall reversal. This is Isaiah 11, verse 6. He says, the wolf shall lie down with the lamb, and the leopard with the young goat, and the calf and the lion and the fattened calf together, and a little child shall lead them. The cow and the bear shall graze, their young shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox. The nursing child shall play over the hole of the cobra, and the weaned child shall put his hand on the adder's den. They shall not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord, as the waters cover the sea. In these verses, Isaiah describes what God's world will be like in the latter days, after he has removed his Genesis 3 curses from creation. In verse 6, he describes the removal of hostility and violence from the animal kingdom so that wolves will be able to lie down with lambs and be led by a little child. In verse 7, he portrays the replacement of such violence with peace and harmony so that lion and ox will graze together on grassy fields. But perhaps most strikingly of all, in verse 8, we're shown a picture of a child playing over the hole of a cobra, signifying the removal of the animosity between the offspring of Eve and the serpent, which was enshrined in the curse of Genesis 3. Instead of hostility, the weaned child will put his hand on the adder's den. He will have nothing to fear from the serpent who once so wrecked God's world, and instead will enjoy perfect peace and knowledge of the Lord, as the waters cover the sea. This picture of the fall being reversed also appears in Isaiah chapter 25. Once again, we find a picture of all the nations being gathered to God's mountain to enjoy life in his blessing. Like an enormous wedding feast, they will enjoy a feast of rich food and well-aged wine. But we also find a striking new promise. He says in verse 6 of Isaiah 25, "On this mountain, the Lord will swallow up the covering that is cast over all peoples, the veil that is spread over all nations. He will swallow up death forever. And the Lord will wipe away tears from all faces, and the reproach of his people he will take away from all the earth." Just as we saw the curses on God's creation being removed in chapter 11, so here we find the most devastating curse, that of death itself, being swallowed up by the life-giving God. His blessing will be restored on his world. Finally, in the latter days, there will be a new heavens and a new earth. The dramatic picture of worldwide resurrection revealed in Isaiah 25 finds its natural conclusion in Isaiah's climactic description of the new creation in chapter 65. There we find a concluding oracle in verse 17 in which God declares, "Behold, I create new heavens and a new earth, and the former things shall not be remembered or come into mind, but be glad and rejoice forever in that which I create." Then it says, "No more shall there be in Zion an infant who lives but a few days, or an old man who does not fill out his days, for the young man shall die 100 years old, and the sinner 100 years old shall be accursed. They shall not labor in vain or bear children for calamity, for they shall be the offspring of the blessed of the Lord, and their descendants with them. The wolf and the lamb shall graze together, the lion shall eat straw like the ox, and dust shall be the serpent's food. They shall not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain." These verses, they act as a kind of kaleidoscopic summary of all Isaiah's future promises. We see God's mountain in a new Jerusalem as the center of God's new world. We see his people rejoicing in the life that they enjoy there. We see death swallowed up in the picture of young men living to 100 years. And we see the repetition of the promises from chapter 11, when in verse 25 we see the wolf and the lamb lying down together next to the serpent crushed in the dust. It's an incredible fulfillment of Isaiah's vision in chapter 2, verse 1 to 4. And it's one which should make us rejoice in the new creation hope that God has given us. Likewise, it should make us realize how futile it is to live for this world when God has promised to make a new one. But most of all, it should give us great confidence. God will restore his blessing on his world, just as Moses said he would, and he will do it in a new creation, which far exceeds all we could ever ask or imagine. Why don't we pause to discuss those points there, and then we'll come back together in a few minutes. In the last part of that talk, we kind of gave a whistle-stop tour of all of the most thrilling positive passages in Isaiah. But in the next part of this session, I want to address the most obvious question that arises from those promises. How can they possibly be fulfilled? When Isaiah wrote these promises, Israel was as far from fulfilling them as she possibly could have been. Instead of drawing the nations to the mountain of the house of the Lord, she had joined the nations in their rebellion against him. She'd filled her land with idols and was bowing down to the work of her own hands. Isaiah knew from Moses that God had promised to restore his blessing on the world. But how could he possibly do it? Well, just as Moses had given Isaiah the basis for his new creation promises, so it was in Moses that Isaiah found the means through which God would fulfill them. Moses had seen a day when God tore down human pride and idolatry. Moses had seen a day when God exalted his mountain as the highest of the mountains. Moses had seen a day when God drew a people to himself to walk in obedience to his law and enjoy life in his presence. Moses had seen the Exodus, and he had promised that God would restore his blessing on the world by doing it again. And so Isaiah, standing on the walls of Jerusalem with Moses in one hand and his pen in the other, predicted that God would bring about his new creation through a day of new Exodus. Have a look with me at Isaiah chapter 2, verse 5. O house of Jacob, come, let us walk in the light of the Lord. For you have rejected your people, the house of Jacob, because they are full of things from the east and of fortune tellers like the Philistines, and they strike hands with the children of foreigners. Their land is filled with silver and gold, and there is no end to their treasures. Their land is filled with horses, and there is no end to their chariots. Their land is filled with idols. They bow down to the work of their hands, to what their own fingers have made. So man is humbled, and each one is brought low. Do not forgive them. Enter into the rock and hide into the dust from before the terror of the Lord and from the splendor of his majesty. The haughty looks of man shall be brought low, and the lofty pride of men shall be humbled, and the Lord alone will be exalted in that day. For the Lord of hosts has a day against all that is proud and lofty, against all that is lifted up, and it shall be brought low. Against all the cedars of Lebanon, lofty and lifted up, and against all the oaks of Bashan, against all the lofty mountains, and against all the uplifted hills, against every high tower, and against every fortified wall, against all the ships of Tarshish, and against all the beautiful craft, and the haughtiness of man shall be humbled, and the lofty pride of men shall be brought low, and the Lord alone will be exalted in that day. And the idols shall utterly pass away, and people shall enter the caves of the rocks and the holes of the ground from before the terror of the Lord and from the splendor of his majesty. when he rises to terrify the earth. In that day, mankind will cast away their idols of silver and their idols of gold, which they made for themselves to worship, to the moles and to the bats, to enter the caverns of the rocks and the clefts of the cliffs, from before the terror of the Lord, and from the splendor of his majesty, when he rises to terrify the earth. These verses immediately follow Isaiah's vision of God's latter day salvation, and they describe a day when God will act in judgment as he did in the Exodus. Like the Exodus, this will be a day of human humbling. Everything proud and lofty which lifts itself up in rebellion against God will be cut down, and the self-exultant idols which men have replaced the living God with will be thrown aside as they run in terror from the God they have rejected. It will be a day of human humbling. And it will be a day of divine exaltation. Just as God's judgment in the Exodus revealed his supremacy, so this day will finally prove that there is one God who rules the world. Verse 11, and again in verse 17, in that day, the Lord alone will be exalted. Isaiah has placed this picture next to his latter days vision because the one leads to the other. Chapter 2, verse 1 to 4 describes a future where God alone is exalted, where the nations submit to his unrivaled rule. But these verses show that that can only happen when God rids his world of human pride once and for all and lifts himself up as true king over all the earth. For new creation, there must be a new Exodus day of human humbling and divine exaltation. But when this day comes, it must leave a humble remnant of humanity to submit to God's rule. There are people left in 2 verse 1 to 4, the people who say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the house of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. So it must be a day of new Exodus salvation, where a humbled remnant is redeemed, as well as of judgment and revelation. Strikingly, it's a day which Isaiah himself experienced in miniature. In Isaiah chapter 6, the prophet describes his commissioning and says he suddenly saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up. It's a vision of sudden divine exaltation, just like the new Exodus day. Then in verse 5, he falls to the ground in response, shouting, woe is me, for I am a man of unclean lips, and my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. Again, it's a vision of a human humbled, as the rest of mankind will be on God's new Exodus day. But when in verse 6, Isaiah's lips are burned with coal from the altar of God's judgment, his guilt is burned away and his sin atoned for, just as God's future day will purify the world of idolatry and sin. It's a personal experience of the day when God appears in glory to humble human pride and purify his world of sin in the fire of his judgment. The rest of Isaiah is primarily concerned with asking what kind of day will fulfill the vision of chapters 2 and 6. And the majority of the book is structured around three candidates. Firstly, in chapters 7 to 39, candidate 1, the day of Assyria. Then in chapters 40 to 48, candidate 2, the day of Babylon. And then finally, candidate number 3 in chapters 49 to 55, the day of the servant. We begin with the day of Assyria. Isaiah's active ministry spanned the mid-8th century BC to the early 7th century BC, a period which was dominated by the foreboding advance of the Assyrian Empire. After the ascension of the Assyrian king, Tiglath-Pileser III, in 745 BC, Assyria became the world's dominant power and began rapidly swallowing up all its neighbors. In 721 BC, Assyria destroyed the northern kingdom of Israel, razing its capital in Samaria and carting its people off into exile. And then from 705 BC, Isaiah saw Assyria making further and further advances into the southern kingdom of Judah. By 701 BC, she had taken all but Jerusalem, which stood alone before the Assyrian juggernaut. Remarkably, Isaiah, a solitary prophet in a minor Palestinian backwater, had seen all of this coming. And he said, the day of Assyria's arrival would be a day of new exodus. Firstly, he said it would be a day of human humbling. In Isaiah 7-12, he predicts the humbling of Israel and its idols. First, in chapters 7 and 8, he tells Judah's unbelieving king that God will bring Assyria flooding into his land like a bursting river, leaving only Jerusalem above water. Then in chapters 9 and 10, he pronounces a similar judgment on the northern kingdom, telling them that the day of punishment is coming through God's Assyrian rod of anger. Next, Isaiah predicts the humbling of humanity and its idols. Chapters 13-24 are bookended by pictures of judgment on the whole world, of the whole world being scorched and devoured, and of men running in terror from the fierce anger of the Lord. It's deliberately reminiscent of chapter 2. But this time it's clear how God is going to do it. The oracles between those two pictures in chapters 13 and 24 describe two Assyrian advances, one led by Sargon II, and another led by King Sennacherib. The point of each is clear. God's worldwide judgment will be brought by the Assyrian Empire. Through her global conquests, God will expose the foolishness of the nation's pride and the useless vanity of their idols in a day of human humbling. But Isaiah also said it would be a day of divine exaltation. God was using Assyria to judge the earth for his glory, not for Assyria's. Indeed, no nation on earth encapsulated the arrogant pride which God was using Assyria to judge more than Assyria herself. And so, having used her for his campaign of worldwide human humbling, Isaiah said God would finish the job by crushing Assyria outside Jerusalem, proving himself to be the planet's true superpower. To show this, he concludes each of the judgment oracles in chapters 7-12 and 13-24 with pictures of Assyria's downfall, perhaps the clearest being in chapter 14, where he clothes Assyria in the language of Genesis 11. Like Babel, Assyria was intent on exalting herself into the heavens, but would ultimately be cut down to the ground and cursed. Strikingly, Isaiah also highlights the key role of God's king in Assyria's downfall. In both chapters 9 and 11, it is the king whose rule will break the rod of Assyrian oppression, and it is the king whose words will kill the wicked world power. Through him, God will exalt himself by triumphing over the greatest empire in the world for all the nations to see in a day of divine exaltation. And through this day, God will force the nations to recognize him, not Assyria, not Egypt, not anyone else, as the world's true king, enabling him to gather them in a day of new Exodus salvation to live under his rule and enjoy his blessing. As it says in chapter 11, God will extend his hand yet a second time, and there will be a highway from Assyria for the remnant that remains of his people, as there was for Israel when they came up from Egypt. In that day, the whole world will join in Moses' song of praise to God in a day of new exodus. Incredibly, it's a day which Isaiah witnessed. Isaiah was there in 701 BC when Assyria turned on Jerusalem. And in chapter 36, we find his eyewitness account of the incredible fulfillment of his predictions. He tells us that on that day, humanity was humble. The idols of the nations were raised to the ground, and Assyria, boasting that the Lord couldn't deliver, was sent back to Nineveh with her tail between her legs. Not only that, but on that day, the Lord was exalted. He single-handedly brought down the most powerful nation on earth, smiting 185,000 Assyrian soldiers to defend his city. As promised, he did so through the words of his king, the righteous king Hezekiah, whose words of prayer that God would show all the earth that he alone is Lord, defeated the oppressor. All this means the day Isaiah witnessed should have been a day of new Exodus salvation, a day when the nations flowed to the God who had defeated the world's supreme power. But that isn't how Isaiah 1 to 39 finishes. In chapters 38 and 39, we find a peculiar parallel with God's victory. Once again, we find King Hezekiah in a dire situation, at this time, fatal illness, and he is delivered by God in response to a humble prayer. But crucially, God's deliverance is temporary. He simply adds 15 years to Hezekiah's life. And Isaiah seems to think the same is true of Jerusalem. It was a day of human humbling. And it was a day of divine exaltation, but not a lasting one. Humanity would soon forget what God had done and return to their natural state of self-worship. Isaiah, he illustrates this by including a short story in chapter 39 about Hezekiah's proud desire to show off his riches to a group of Babylonian envoys. His point is, even Hezekiah, even the king whose righteous prayer had delivered Jerusalem, couldn't resist the temptation of Babel-like pride for long. For new Exodus salvation, a fuller, more thorough, more lasting day of human humbling was required. And so Isaiah 7 to 39 concludes by predicting a new day of judgment, the day of Jerusalem's exile to Babylon. The day of Assyria was not God's new exodus. It's worth pausing to appreciate what a crisis this was in Isaiah's own message. Throughout his ministry, he'd said that this day would turn Israel and the nations back to their God. But in the end, it only confirmed that Jerusalem itself would have to go into exile. Of course, Moses had said that Israel would have to go into exile too. And he had said that one day God would bring them back in a new exodus. So as Isaiah stood on the walls of Jerusalem with Moses in his hand, contemplating the inadequacy of the day he'd just witnessed, he looked beyond his own day to Jerusalem's coming exile in Babylon and their return to consider whether that might be the day for God's new exodus. And so secondly, Isaiah looks forward to the day of Babylon. Whereas Assyria had reached up to the gates of Jerusalem, Babylon would reach into Jerusalem itself, humbling the idolatrous pride within the city and carrying its inhabitants into exile. It would be an even greater day of humbling for Israel and her idols. But it would also be a greater day of humbling for the nations. Isaiah 40 begins by announcing Israel's return from Babylon. "Comfort, comfort my people," says your God. "Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and cry to her that her warfare is ended." The time will come, as Moses promised, for Israel to come home. In chapter 45, Isaiah prophesies that Cyrus, the future king of Persia, will be raised up by God to enable this return. But in chapter 47, he says that through Cyrus, God will also humble the idolatrous pride of Babylon. Like Assyria, Babylon boasted of being the world's sole superpower whom none could displace. But just as God brought down Assyria, so through Cyrus, he will destroy Babylon, and none of her idols or sorcerers will be able to turn it back. It will be a day of human humbling. Likewise, it will be a day of divine exaltation. Isaiah 40 contains the richest sermon on God's creation power in the whole Bible. And the section thereafter repeatedly mentions God's Exodus name, "I am." 34 times in the section, God says, "I am, and there is none like me." His point is that, like the Exodus, this rescue is one that only the Creator God of all the earth could do. Raising up Cyrus, destroying Babylon, redeeming Israel, will reveal to the whole world that the Lord alone is God. It will be a day of divine exaltation. Thirdly, it will be a day of new Exodus salvation. Remember how in the Exodus God redeemed Israel from death in Egypt to life in his land. Well, in the same way, Isaiah sees Israel's return and he says that God will redeem her from death in Babylon back to life in his land. It will be a new Exodus for Israel. But it will also be a new Exodus for the nations. Throughout Isaiah 40 to 48, God repeatedly refers to Israel as his servant. It's a key role, and it's defined in Isaiah chapter 42, verse 1, where God says that his servant will bring justice to the nations. Justice here doesn't refer to social or to legal justice, but to the right order of God's creation. It means the restoration of God's rule and blessing over his world, just as it was pictured in chapter 2, verses 1 to 4. So by calling Israel his servant, God is saying they will draw the nations to his rule and blessing. As he draws them out of exile in Babylon, they will draw the nations from the exile of Babel as they proclaim God's revelation of his supremacy revealed in his rescue. Thus, the day of Babylon will be a new Exodus, not only for Israel, but for the whole world. Isaiah, as he stood on the walls of Jerusalem, could see that these things would be. But his experience with Assyria had taught him to ask a crucial question. Would it last? In the first Exodus, God had crushed the idols of Egypt and revealed his supremacy over creation, only for Israel to immediately start grumbling and making golden calves to replace him with. Then in Isaiah's own day, God had swept away the world's idols and delivered his people from Assyria, only to see even Hezekiah, Israel's most righteous king, eventually return to idolatrous pride. As he stood on the walls of Jerusalem, contemplating Israel's future exile and return, Isaiah could see that it would be no different. The section concludes with a rising cacophony of frustration at Israel's inability to fulfill her role as God's servant. Just as she had grumbled on her way out of Egypt, she will grumble on the way out of Babylon, refusing to obey the Lord or to proclaim his greatness. And so Isaiah, in 48 verse 22, pronounces the judgment. There is no peace, says the Lord, for the wicked. The day of Babylon would not be God's new exodus. But Isaiah could see a day that would be the day of the servant. Throughout Isaiah 40 to 48, God referred to Israel as his servant, but in chapter 49, verses 1 to 6, he introduces a new servant. He is called Israel. But in verse 5, he says he has been raised up to save Israel. Not only that, but in verse 6, he adds that through him, God will extend his salvation to the very ends of the earth. This new servant, he will be the one through whom God saves Israel and the world, fulfilling his promise to Abraham and Moses' vision of the latter days. In chapter 51, Isaiah says this servant will enable God to remove his wrath from Israel and to replace the curse of his judgment with the blessing of his original creation. Then in chapter 52, he announces the imminent arrival of God's new creation kingdom, saying, "Break forth into singing, you waste places of Jerusalem, for the Lord has comforted his people. And all the ends of the earth shall see the salvation of our God." It's a moment of great anticipation. The moment for the latter days is here. The moment for a day which will do what Egypt, Assyria, and Babylon couldn't. But as yet, the crucial question remains unanswered. How can this servant achieve what no other day could? How could this servant do what Egypt, or God's rescue from Assyria, or the immense deliverance of his people from Babylon couldn't? How will this day rid the world of human pride and idolatry? How will this day reveal the supremacy of the living God? How will this day enable people to enjoy lasting new creation? It's with this question that we approach Isaiah 53, where we find a description of an altogether different new Exodus day. It will be a day of human humbling, but not for Israel, nor for the nations. This will be a day of human humbling for God's servant. He will humble himself, suffering to the point of being marred beyond human semblance and becoming a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief. At the crux of the chapter, in verses 4 to 6, Isaiah unveils the purpose of his suffering. Have a look with me at Isaiah 53, verse 4. Isaiah 53, 4. "Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace. And with his wounds, we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned every one to his own way. And the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. The Exodus was a day of human humbling. The day of God's rescue from Assyria was a day of human humbling. Babylon brought a day of human humbling. The idols of Israel and the nations were smashed in powerful acts of judgment. But they didn't last. But when God's servant is humbled, he will make a full and lasting atonement for the idolatrous rebellion of God's people and God's world. He will be pierced for our transgressions and crushed for our iniquities. And like the Passover lamb in Exodus, he will die our death as a substitutionary sacrifice to take God's wrath at our sin. It will be a day of human humbling. And through his death, the servant's humility will become a day of divine exaltation. As it says in chapter 52, verse 13, "My servant shall prosper and be high and lifted up and exalted, just as God in chapter 6 was high and lifted up upon his throne. So this servant will reveal the glory of the Lord." But his glory isn't God's mighty arm crushing Egypt, Assyria, or Babylon. No, his glory will be the arm of the Lord crushing the power of sin to condemn his world to death. And through his glory, he will fulfill the promise of Genesis 3:15 for a hero to crush the serpent's head and lead God's new exodus. As a reward for his work, God will exalt him as Lord over his creation, dividing with him a portion with the strong, because he poured his soul out to death and bore the sin of many. God's humbled servant will be his universal king who reveals his glory in a day of divine exaltation. Finally, it will be a day of new exodus salvation. Chapter 53 is followed by two pictures in chapter 54 and chapter 55. In the first, we see that God's people, diminished by the judgment of exile like a barren woman, will explode with new creation life and fill the world with offspring. They will be married to God in perfect relationship with him. He will be their bridegroom, their husband, and he promises never to be angry with them again. Not only that, but they will enjoy this new relationship in a perfect city built on foundations of sapphire with pinnacles of agate under the secure protection of their God. It's a wonderful picture of new creation life. And in chapter 55, the gates are thrown open to the whole world. Come, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters, and he who has no money, come, buy and eat. Come, buy wine and milk without money and without price. Come, hear that your soul may live. It's a day of new creation for the whole world because of the servant's day of new exodus. God's new creation, the one God promised to Abraham, the one Moses looked for, the one Isaiah wrote about, will come not through Egypt, nor from rescue from Assyria or Babylon, but through the servant being lifted up to make sinners righteous by his blood. Let's take a quick break for discussion there. Great, let's draw back together. You will be pleased to know that that is without doubt the longest single continuous section of this day so far. And we've now covered most of the content in the book of Isaiah. And therefore, I wanted to use this final part of the session to think a bit about response. Now, what was Isaiah's purpose? How did he want his readers to respond to this vision of God's new exodus to a new creation? The foundation of Isaiah's answer appears in his paradigmatic introduction in chapter 2. In verse 22, in the concluding verse, where he appeals for his readers to stop regarding man, in whose nostrils is the breath of life, for of what account is he? It makes sense, doesn't it? If God's purpose is to rid his world of human pride in order to re-establish his rightful rule over it, it makes sense for Isaiah to call his readers to reject their own proud regard for themselves as rulers of their own lives. Instead, they should humble themselves and submit to God's rule, just as the whole world will do when the new creation comes. Together, they should say with the nations in chapter 2, verse 4, "Come, let us go up to the mountain of the house of the Lord, that he may teach us his ways, and that we may walk in his paths." Isaiah's purpose, then, it seems to be that his readers would humble themselves by turning from the proud self-rule which God will one day rid from his world, and by submitting to him as their only Lord. This point gets expanded in the final section of the book, which runs from chapters 56 to 66. The section has a basic chiastic structure, a sandwich structure, which I've included in a diagram on your handouts. It's a little bit of an oversimplification, but I think it's accurate nevertheless. And it begins with the same contrast which we saw in chapter 2. On the one hand, God makes an offer of salvation to humble outsiders. Now, anyone, even foreigners and eunuchs who would ordinarily be cut off from God's people, can be included in his new creation kingdom if they humble themselves before him. As he promises in chapter 56, verse 4, "To the eunuchs who keep my Sabbaths, who choose the things that please me and hold fast my covenant, I will give in my house and within my walls a monument and a name better than sons and daughters." On the other hand, God promises judgment for proud, idolatrous insiders. Any Israelite, in spite of their heritage and their ethnic credentials, who persists in self-worship, will be cut off from their inheritance. As he said before at the end of chapter 48, and now repeats at the end of chapter 57, "There is no peace, says my God, for the wicked." There can only be judgment for the proud, even in Israel. Of course, the issue of response in Isaiah raises the crucial subject of blindness. If you know Isaiah, then you'll remember that back in chapter 6, when Isaiah receives his commissioning, God commanded him to make the heart of his people dull and their ears heavy and to blind their eyes in order to keep them from repenting. The purpose of this blindness was to enable God to send the judgment through which he would humble human pride and reveal his supremacy. But it also raises a tricky question. How can you respond to Isaiah's message if you're blind? If it's impossible to turn to God with total obedience, if it's impossible to fully suppress the pride in our own hearts, how can you receive God's salvation? The answer to this question is provided in two prayers in chapters 56 to 66, which together form the next layer of that sandwich structure and which model the way for blind people to respond to Isaiah's message. Firstly, we see that the humble blind man will confess his sin. In the second half of chapter 59, we find the prayer of a self-evidently blind person. He admits himself in chapter 59, verse 10, "We grope for the wall like the blind. We grope like those who have no eyes. We hope for justice, but there is none. For salvation, but it is far from us." Clearly, he is blind, kept by his human nature from fully turning from his sin in obedience to God. But in his blindness, he humbles himself by frankly confessing his blind sinfulness. In verse 12, he admits, "Our transgressions are multiplied before you, and our sins testify against us. For our transgressions are with us, and we know our iniquities." It shows us that even the blind can respond to Isaiah's message if they will admit their need for it. The humble blind man will confess his sin. But secondly, we see that the humble blind man will cry out for salvation. The second prayer comes halfway through chapter 63, where we find our blind man not so much confessing his sin as crying out to God for a saviour. He recounts God's faithfulness in the Exodus, and he calls on him to look down from heaven and see the devastation of his people caused by his judgment on their sin. But critically, he acknowledges that their own blind sinfulness is the cause of their plight. In verse 17, he asks, "Lord, why do you make us wander from your ways and harden our hearts so that we fear you not?" He knows God's wrath at their sin is their biggest problem. And so he prays that God would remove it. Chapter 64, verse 9. "Be not so terribly angry, O Lord, and remember not iniquity forever." The humble blind man will cry out for salvation. The reason for this emphasis on response is that at the center of the section lies a pivotally important truth. And thus far, Isaiah's original readers might have been forgiven for thinking that the servant's work was for Israel. I mean, after all, the Exodus was for Israel. God's deliverance from Assyria was for Israel. The rescue from Babylon was for Israel. Yes, the nations were included, but only insofar as they came to Israel. But the same will not be true for the servant's salvation. He is now the one all must come to, including Israel. And when he comes, not only will he save those who have come to him, he will judge those who don't, even if they're Israelites. In Isaiah 61, verse 1, the central verses of the entire section, he announces, "The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and the opening of the prison to those who are bound, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favour and the day of vengeance of our God." In these verses, the servant announces his twofold task. On the one hand, he has come to bring good news to the poor, to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and the recovery of sight to the blind. He has come to bring salvation, good news, healing, liberty, and sight for the humble, the poor, the brokenhearted, the captive, and the blind. He has come to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. But on the other hand, he has come to bring God's day of vengeance. It's a picture that gets expanded in chapter 63, verses 1 to 6, where it describes him trampling down the peoples in anger and making them drunk in his wrath, pouring out their lifeblood on the earth. God's servant will not only come to die a new Exodus death for salvation, he will come to bring eternal judgment on the proud. It's with this contrast that Isaiah wraps up the entire book. In the very final verses of Isaiah, in chapter 66, verse 22, God announces the imperishability of his new heavens and his new earth, saying, "As the new heavens and the new earth that I make shall remain before me, says the Lord, so shall your offspring and your name remain. From new moon to new moon and Sabbath to Sabbath, all flesh shall come to worship before me." It's a glorious picture of all those who humbly accept God's servant, enjoying life in God's new creation. But in verse 24, we find another all flesh. He says, "They shall go out and look on the dead bodies of the men who have rebelled against me. For their worm shall not die, their fire shall not be quenched, and they shall be an abhorrence to all flesh." The contrast couldn't be more stark, and Isaiah's purpose couldn't be clearer. Humbly accept new creation life through God's servant and his new exodus, or face the eternal condemnation which awaits all proud humanity's opposition to God. Humbly accept new creation life through God's servant and his new exodus, or face the eternal condemnation that awaits all of proud humanity's opposition to God. Isaiah saw all this standing on the walls of Jerusalem in 701 BC, 700 years after the prophet Moses. And 700 years later, the apostle John, as he stood on the Galilean shore, saw all that Moses and Isaiah wrote about coming to pass. But before that, let's have lunch.